Hey everybody, I am Mark Lamont Hill. I am a professor, a scholar, and most importantly, a book nerd. I say book nerd because I don't just love to read books. I'm the person who loves to read about the book. I love hearing authors talk about how and why they wrote the book, and I love talking to other book nerds about their favorite books. That's why I started Coffee and Books. It's a podcast all about books. Every episode, I sit down over a cup of coffee with the world's biggest authors and discuss the most interesting, controversial, fun, and important books. And sometimes I hang out with experts, fans, and other special guests to talk about some of the greatest books of all time. So it's been a while since I've seen you all. That is absolutely true. It's been almost a year. We took a break and we're back with another season of Coffee and Books. And as I was starting the season back up, I had to do a couple of things. One, I had to remember my intro, which is why I had to read it off of paper today. I also had to figure out how to start a new season of Coffee and Books because so many people were reaching out to me asking me how to do it and when I was going to do it. So first thing I said is we got to come back bigger and better than ever. So this is why now Coffee and Books is not just an audio podcast that you can catch wherever all podcasts are listened to. But you can also watch us on video. We will be on the Uncle Bobby's YouTube channel. We'll be on social media. Clips will be on social media anyway through Uncle Bobby's and my own personal page. So you can see the authors, talk to the authors at the same time that we are doing all this other stuff. So normally I start a season with a bang. And I said, I need the coolest book, the biggest name, the best author I can get, the greatest conversation I can have to start off a season. And then I remember my book is coming out. And I said, an even better way to start a season is to start the season with a book that I co-wrote with my dear friend, my dear colleague, who I am going to introduce right now, the great Todd Brewster. Todd, good to see you.
Good to see you, Mark.
Now, Todd is a journalist. He's been an editor for Time and Life. He was a senior producer for ABC News. And he is a wonderful writer who has written and co-written a bunch of amazing books. My favorite book of his, of course, is Lincoln's Gamble. But he co-wrote with the late Peter Jennings, The Century, which for many people is a book that's on their shelf. It's a book that, I mean, it wasn't just a bestseller. It was really just a monster of a book that had an extraordinary impact on the public. We'll talk about that too. But Todd is a great guy, and I'm so excited about our new book, Seen and Unseen, Technology, Social Media, and the Fight for Racial Justice. Seen and Unseen, Technology, Social Media, and the Fight for Racial Justice. I am very, 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 very excited to talk about our book and to talk about it with Todd. So Todd, really, thank you for doing this. Thank you for being the first guest of a new season, and thanks for doing this book with me.
Well, I'm very honored to be the first guest. I'm honored to be doing a book with you. I mean, that was it was a real treat, and we had a great collaboration. I really enjoyed it. Yeah.
So let's start by talking about the book, so people know exactly why we're here. The book Seen and Unseen. I want to give you the opportunity to maybe lay out a little bit of what the book is about.
Yeah. So you'll remember, Mark, but I'll tell your audience that we were, like everyone in the world, stunned by what happened in Minneapolis in May of 2020, looking for a way to respond to it. I think journalists, authors, professors all need to sort of contribute to the public conversation when something like that happens. It's part of our professional duty. And so you and I had a lot of conversations about what was it that made the killing of George Floyd resonate so deeply throughout, not just the United States, but throughout the world. And we landed on a number of thoughts, a number of reasons for it. But the one that stuck out was the role of technology, the role of the cell phone video, the role of social media, the role of technology in the world's conversation right now in this moment in the 21st century. And as we spoke about that more, we began to explore the role of technology and media in the story of race in America, going all the way back to the 19th century. It was stunning to see the way that film, still photography, motion pictures, the work of journalists, the work of filmmakers, the work of authors, the work of those covering the civil rights movement, those who created the stunning films of the early part of the film era in the early 20th century, the role of the still photograph in terms of exposing the horrors of lynching in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. And we realized that in many ways, technology has driven the story of race in America. And so we chose four principal episodes of the past couple of years. And that would include the Ahmaud Arbery killing, of course, George Floyd, the march in Charlottesville that resulted in the death there of one of those protesting on the streets of Charlottesville. And then the Kenosha, Wisconsin violence also. And each of them seemed to articulate one aspect, one part, one flavor, so to speak, of what technology has, the role technology has played in terms of our understanding of race, in particular, the state violence against Black people. And it was very illuminating. I mean, I love when books books are a journey. I think you'd agree with that. You start out with one kind of idea, and then in over the course of the work, it becomes organically changed, and usually for the better. And I think that as we began to grapple with each of these stories and look at them in great detail, and to see the historical resonances that were appearing in these stories, we saw the shape of the book really come into focus.
Yeah, I agree. I remember when we were brainstorming ideas, and the George Floyd was the obvious one, because there was a national movement sort of around what was happening with George Floyd. And as you said, it sparked our thinking as we were trying to make sense of the moment. But I remember one of the ones that came to my mind initially was Janiqua Charles.
Mm-hmm.
And for those that don't know, you may not know her by name, but you probably know the meme, you probably know the clip. She is a woman in South Dillon, South Carolina, who was detained outside of a gentleman's club. And because she was wrongfully detained in her estimation, she started to sing and dance, singing, "You about to lose your job. You about to lose your job." And it was a really interesting moment because on the one hand, it represented a kind of resistance to state power, although he was not a police officer in that function. He was a private security person who actually was tickled by the whole incident.
I think he posted on his Facebook page.
He put it on his Facebook later. He's like, he said, not to make light of the situation, but this is funny, you know. But there were people who are suddenly knowing their rights and articulating their rights. And the reason she thought he was about to lose his job was because of the technology. It was the camera that allowed her to feel empowered. She wouldn't have said that just because she was being, you know, detained in front of a strip club. It was because she felt like the camera had some power to not just democratize, but to give her access to a certain kind of justice that may have been denied to the socially vulnerable in this country. So for me, you know, I remember at that moment, I was like, okay, this book is going to be fun and interesting because it's not just about death. Although there's a lot of death, you know, but it's about how racial justice gets achieved through these technologies. And sometimes it's justice against a wrongful detainment, a wrongful arrest. Sometimes it's justice against narratives of Blackness that are improperly articulated. Think about when we talk about Frederick Douglass, and because this book goes throughout history, and we'll talk about that in a second. And sort of how even Frederick Douglass is able to sort of not just offer a different narrative of himself through the technology of the photograph, and I would argue even the book, but he's also able to do it. But he's also able to offer it a new narrative of Black people, because in many ways, for many white people, Frederick Douglass was the only Black person they were going to meet. And he was the only Black person that they were going to have access to. And so while he was regaling them with stories of abolition visions and they were demanding that he talk about the brutality of slavery, they were also witnessing a Black person. And this technology helped them do that. So for me, this book was an excellent opportunity. I learned so much about technology, about thinking about media more broadly. And finally, I would say just like one of the takeaways for me that I went into the book with, but it was complicated for me, is that we have to think about technology in a broader way as well, and media in a broader way as well, when we look throughout history. Which brings me to the next piece of this, man, which is, you know, because the first question people always ask is, why would you two work together? Now, you know, not knowing anything about either of us necessarily, it's not the Hatfields and the McCoys or anything, but the idea is, like, given our respective areas of work, given our different types of training, you work as a historian. I do not. It's always interesting sort of what each of us brings to the table and why we thought that would be a good fit. In terms of the scope of the book, how do you think things came together in that way?
Oh, I think first of all, I do think that there's the one thing you did not touch on, which is, I think, significant, is that you're black and I'm white. And,
right.
And that's significant.
I don't see race, Todd. Yeah.
I think that's significant for just because I think it demonstrates the breadth of our vision here, right? I mean, it shows that we're not speaking from a constituency, where the truth doesn't have a constituency, right? Truth should be something that is legitimized across all platforms, and I like that. In fact, you remember that one of the first ideas for the title for the book was black and white, and yes. And that had the double meaning, of course, both the fact that referencing you and me, but more obviously the role of referencing photography and the notion of technology that is in the phrase black and white. But it turns out there are a lot of other books called black and white, so we yes. ended up not going with that. But I love the title as we have it, Seen and Unseen, which, you know, there's a lot of aspects of duality throughout this book, race as a duality, right? There's a seen and unseen is its own reference to a duality, what you see and what you don't see, right? Just as an aside for your listeners, that comes from, inspired in part by a James Baldwin book called The Evidence of Things Not Seen, which was his book about the Atlanta child murders of the early 1980s. And yet I think even then it calls for something, a biblical reference that he was familiar with. But this notion of a collaboration of you and me and the subject, I mean, I feel as though we touched on a lot of aspects of where you brought something of the contemporary scene. You most of the writing of this book, you were doing your show on Black News Channel, and so you had daily, you were sort of on top of every single event that was happening. I was able to be more reflective in looking back through the historical resonances, and so I think that we each brought something different to the table, but I think we have a common sensibility. I mean, we met, as you said, the other day, about 8 years ago, and I felt an instant sense of comfort with you, and that we would be good friends, whether we would work together or not. I knew we would be good friends. I certainly had respected your work to that point, and have respected even more now that we've worked together. But I think it's also an interesting thing to think about, that a collaboration that works, and I strongly believe our collaboration works, is itself a demonstration of a kind of a communitarian value, right? I mean, we're talking to each other. This is the result of conversations. This is the result of a kind of organic process of adventure too, frankly. I mean, you said that you learned a lot going through this process. So did I, you know, and we shared that adventure. We were able to see things I always say to my students, writing makes you precise, because you look at something, you say, well, okay, it's square. No, it's not quite square. It's a rectangle. Well, it's not quite a rectangle. There's these edges over here. And the more deeply you go into it, the more completely you're able to see what's in front of you. And again, that comes back to seen and unseen, right? Because it reflects on the nature of any of these technologies, from writing itself through all the way through to the present moment, that what do we see? And do we see the truth, or is the truth linger someplace outside of the frame, right?
Yeah, No, I think that's exactly right. And in terms of the content of the book, I think that collaboration and those different perspectives and takes allow us to not just look at how media and technology are shaping the fight for racial justice in the 21st century, even the late 20th century, but also how there have been these moments, these watershed moments in the 18th century, certainly in the 19th century and 20th century, as we talk about in the book, that also shape our way of thinking about race in the national and public conversation about race. One of those moments that we get at in the book is Birth of a Nation.
Yeah.
You know, Birth of a Nation is such a fascinating moment in American history. It's the first film of any sort shown at the White House under President Wilson. It is a film that is technologically a game changer. Mm. You know, it would be difficult to not talk about Birth of a Nation if you're talking about sort of the technological sophistication and creative sophistication of the film genre. But it's also one of the most pejorative, one of the most morally grotesque film representations I've ever seen. You know, when you think about it as a kind of document, organizing tool of the Ku Klux Klan, if you think about it as a representation of Black people as subhuman, as lazy, as violent, as sexual predators, etc., if you see it as a kind of tool of those who are trying to hold on to mythic narratives of the Southern past, if you think about it like that, Birth of a Nation becomes a very complicated and messy text. But it wasn't just an important artifact of an old era of racism or even of the film industry. It's also a text that shapes how we think and talk about race in America and sparked a really extraordinary response. Can you talk a little bit about the relationship of Birth of a Nation to this?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, as we were working on the chapter about the birth of a Nation, I don't even remember whether we included this or not, but I kept on thinking of the Leni Riefenstahl film, The Triumph of the Will. Leni Riefenstahl was another brilliant filmmaker. She was a Nazi. She worked for Hitler. And the film is stunning as a representation of the filmic art, you know. And so it raises this peculiar question that when art is in service of evil,
yes.
First of all, it shows you that these tools of media, these tools of art, are amoral. They don't come with justice included in a bundle with them. But you also realize how dangerous these tools can be. You know, they can be extraordinary progressive tools, and they can be extraordinary regressive tools. And the Birth of a Nation, because it was the first sort of feature-length film, there had been sort of Nickelodeon films before that, little short little things that were, you know, like little demonstrations of like a comedic 5-minute things, you know, but the Birth of a Nation was the first real full length film, and it established really concretely the myth of the lost cause relating to the story of the Civil War, and you think about what changes our understanding of an historical event. And it's popular culture that has done that in the past 120 years. I mean, when you realize the role not only of the Birth of a Nation, but a couple of decades later, the role of Gone with the Wind, instead of establishing this kind of sentimentality about the Confederacy. And you know, one of the things that the Birth of a Nation underscores is this commonality between it's an attempt to underscore the common experience between white Northerners and white Southerners in a way that the filmmaker thought had been disrupted by the Civil War, and that he was bringing the white Northerners back into the fold, so to speak, by showing a film that was the story of two families that confront the war and then eventually are blended together by the end of the movie, united again the North having sort of had this side trip where they somehow got confused that slavery and inequality were bad things, and yet that filters down into the public consciousness. I mean, think of about the sentimentality that attends, the sort of Southern culture even today, right? Where does that come from? Well, it was established very powerfully by the Birth of a Nation, by Gone with the Wind, with these stories of the elegant sort of class of plantation owners. I mean, that's the stuff that, gets beyond the intellectual into the heart, right? And so it helped not only establish, but reestablish this mythic idea of white supremacy. I mean, you really can pinpoint it to popular culture.
And Marcus Garvey, W.E.B. Du Bois, other leaders at the time were trying to gather their own resources to make a film that responded to Birth of a Nation. Unfortunately, they didn't have the resources to do it.
Which itself articulates, one of the most commanding issues with race in America, which is that when one side has all the power and all the capital, there is no equality of message, right? I mean, there's no opportunity. I mean, we talked the other day about the First Amendment. The First Amendment is dependent upon the notion that, or is built upon the notion that conversation, argument leads to better results. But you can't have an argument if one guy has a microphone and the other is muted. Yeah.
So that brings us to this piece about, I'm going to say Twitter, but really all social media. Right. The argument is that now it democratizes things, that now everybody has a megaphone, or at least anybody can have one. Yeah. Right. That anybody can go on Twitter and create a message. In fact, Black Twitter has become a kind of space that I've talked about in other work that I do, a kind of counter public, or, a kind of space where you can push back against the dominant norms and the dominant narratives of the public sphere. Yeah. So that suddenly, we can organize for racial justice. We can say her name and mention, Breonna Taylor. We can force somebody to investigate the killers of Ahmaud Arbery. We can distribute Darnella Frazier's video of George Floyd being killed, right? We can elevate stories until they become movements. If we have access to these new tools of technology, that's the romantic narrative of digital media. And there is some accuracy to that, but help me think through it in a little more complicated way.
Yeah, well, first of all, that's Janiqua Charles, right? I mean, that's what she's demonstrating is that she has a power that she didn't have, and she can force a security guard to lose his job if the film gets out and it's posted on social media. Yes, we have. It is a democratizing technology. People have the power of that they did not have a generation ago. One of the things that we go into in some depth in towards the end of the book is since there's no real organizing principle at work in Twitter, right? I mean, it's like I think we use the reference to it being like a Middle Eastern souk, like a market where everybody is, individuals are all bargaining and shouting, and there's a sense of sort of almost kind of a cacophony there. And I think one of the great things about Black Twitter is that it is an organizing principle, right? I mean, Black Twitter is an organized, it essentially, if you keep the image of the souk, what it does, it's as if someone has stood up and said, oh, all you Black people come over here where we can join together and speak in a protected way here, not without all the other interference of and static that comes from the rest of the souk, and that's what social media has both the progressive quality of democratizing media, but it cries out, it seems to me, for this kind of organizing principle. It cries out for some kind of structure that will organize the message. And once again, it strikes me that often the one who is the first one to organize the message is those who have the power rather than those who did not have the power. You know what I'm speaking about there? Yeah.
Yeah. And there's also a downside to it. I think about, I'm curious to know what you think about this, the kind of ethics of this, right? I mean, when Janiqua Charles says you're about to lose your job, and we all pay attention and we galvanize around it, it becomes the soundtrack to not just social justice movements, but when Trump is about to be outvoted in the re-election, people are making videos with him on it. You know, I mean, it became like a march, and much in the same way that Kendrick Lamar's All Right became a kind of backdrop to the movement in 2014 and in the kind of Ferguson summers. And it's all very interesting. And when someone does something awful, and we use social media to find her name and to find out her job or his job, and we get them fired, whether it's a rogue racist on an airplane or Amy Cooper in Central Park, you know, when she kind of weaponized the police and her whiteness against Christian Cooper, who was a bird watcher, who simply asked her to put her dog on a leash, we all applaud. But that type of thing can also happen to the social justice activist. It can also be used by white supremacists against Jewish people or against Black people. You can dox somebody simply because you don't like that they didn't do a double switch, you know, in the late innings, right? If you're a crazy baseball fan.
Yes. Okay.
I mean, we often sort of romanticize the power of the people to expose and to out, but I mean, what about the other side of it?
Yeah. I mean, there's this, you know, there's a kind of tyranny that's imposed by these technologies, right? I mean, and you know, to the degree that we you know believe in the free society, they've shut down some of our more expressive actions because of the fear that will attend if you say the wrong thing or do the wrong thing, right? That you'll be. I mean, the surveillance. It's a very powerful thing to know that Black people have the tools of surveillance to be able to surveil the state, right? That's one of the really amazing things here. But if we live in a society where everything is surveilled, that's not so good, right? I mean, then we end up in this sort of, it describes a certain kind of tyranny that's reminiscent of the Soviet bloc or something. You know, it ends up being a tyranny of its own. So yeah, I mean, there's these tools are only as good as the people who are using them, finally, right? And you talked about Christian Cooper and Amy Cooper and the story of the Central Park outing and all that. Look, that was a terrible thing, indicative of something that was shows the sort of the systemic racism, it seems to me, because it was a natural knee-jerk reaction to immediately call the police and weaponize the police, as you said, on him. But in terms of a story, it was it became outsized, right? There are much worse things happening to Black people around this country than what was happening to Christian Cooper. And while it's important for Christian Cooper to be
George Floyd killed that same week.
Yeah, exactly. That was the same week. Yes, exactly. And you think about that. So you know, I always think when you think about the television screen, going back, you know, one of the things that is distorting about the television screen is that it's one size, right? So the story about a cute social media meme or something like that is delivered in the same shape and size as the story of the George Floyd being killed. I mean, there's no difference in terms of the rectangle. It's going to be what it is, and they come in a sequence, and it's a linear process, right? So that you don't have the benefit of for instance the old style of a broadsheet newspaper where there's a headline and the headline tells you what's important, and then the secondary story may appear below the fold or on page 7 or page 28. But by its very structure, the newspaper is telling you what is important and what is less important. And we don't have that with some of these technologies. And in terms of Twitter, it's just a rolling series of statements coming one after another. And it doesn't give us this sorting mechanism, this idea that we need to have somebody come in. And we talk about it. You mentioned we need curators. We need people to come tell us what's important and why it's important. And so, as you know, it's like we overcorrected in terms of the amount of freedom we've introduced. Now we need to come back a little bit and elevate to some degree the leading voices, like your own, for instance, to be able to say, okay, this is important for this reason. That's important for that reason. This is less important. How do these events work together to give us a broader kind of perspective on things? And then that, I think, is part what our book does, is that as I've heard you say, you know, you step back and it happened, it's 2 years after George Floyd, but we're now getting a different perspective on it because time has passed. We've understand it more deeply when we go on the story of George Floyd, and we realize, you know, growing up in the Third Ward in Houston, what the Third Ward was like, how the interstates had destroyed the Third Ward, systemic racism that's built into even the architecture of Houston, right?
Yeah.
Even the architecture and the naming of buildings. These are things that, so George Floyd was not an instant. Christian Cooper was not an instant. It was the ongoing narrative that started well before they were even born, right? Yeah.
Absolutely. I was thinking as you were talking about how people will come to this book for George Floyd, and then they'll get this other stuff that you're talking about. Mm. And that's one of the things I want people to understand about this book. You know, and you just gave a perfect example of it, right? We're giving you these major historical or these major contemporary cases, but underneath each of them is a long, rich, and deep history that we delve into. You know, we at times nerd out on it. That's our jam, right? So
yeah,
we love to talk about, you know, the architecture in Houston. We love to talk about the kind of construction of these housing projects that are produced and what that meant for understanding racial equality. We give you Jeniqua Charles, but we also give you Frederick Douglass. You know, we're going into these different areas to help people kind of make sense of what's possible in the contemporary context, but to understand that it's part of a long history, a long trajectory, a long trek toward justice. And at every moment, technology and media has been a central part. I want to pivot a little bit before we go, because I want to ask you a little bit about, in this podcast, Coffee and Books, we always do a conversation, not just about the book, but about the practice of writing.
Mm.
Why are you a writer? How'd you become one?
Mm. Well, I think I'm a writer because I like to I like words, for one thing. I really like words. I like that process I described earlier about coming to terms with something. Again, with my students, one of the things I tell them is go stand in front of a piece of sculpture and see if you see it one way, but then walk around to the other side and see if you see it in a different way. And describe them both to me, you know, it's a lesson not only in words, it's a lesson in perspective, right? I mean, my early history as a journalist was inspired in part by working for a political candidate in Indiana, where I traveled with him to rural Indiana and knocked on doors, and we went in and we talked to people, I was stunned that people would actually be willing to speak to us, and the stories they told, and the way they opened up, and about their fears and about their dreams. And I realized that people want to talk to you, and that it's your obligation to listen. You know, it's your obligation to listen. And I took from that I, you know, maybe there was something that I could contribute that way. So I think that was part of the reason why I'm a writer. I like words. I like people. I like coming to terms with things and learning something new and waking up each day and thinking. I heard you say the other day, wake up, I hope you leave the world a better place that day than it was the day before. I love that idea. I love that idea. But for me, it's like waking up and saying, okay, well, I know these things. I think I know these things. What will challenge my understanding of something today? And how might I kind of express that and put that into words? So that's one of the reasons why I'm a writer. I think the principal reason I'm a writer is I like to feel that I'm participating in the public conversation. I think that's an important thing. If you are alive in 2022, I think in some way you have an obligation to sort of put your imprint on your time. You know, when I used to sign books of the book, The Century, for young people, I would always say to them, you know, this next period of time is yours. Put your mark on it. you know, put something on it. Do, you know, show yourself. Don't be a bystander. Don't retreat. Don't retreat. Engage. Mm,
don't retreat. I like that. Don't retreat. Wow, that's powerful to me. Who inspires you in terms of writing?
In terms of writing, God, there's so many people who inspire me, and they're not all writers. they're not. I mean, musicians. I'm, as you know, a big lover of jazz. I play the piano. I study jazz. I was very pleased yesterday to see Herbie Hancock playing at Madeleine Albright's funeral. I'm a big Herbie Hancock fan. He played Maiden Voyage, one of my favorite Herbie Hancock pieces. There are certain books I'd say more than writers. I love this book called The Great War: Modern Memory. It's not many people probably know it, but it's a book about the First World War, and it was really groundbreaking when it came out, I think probably in the 1980s or something like that, because it was an analysis of the letters and the poetry and the writing of the soldiers of the First World War, and grappling with violence, state violence there of a different character than the time we're talking about mostly today. But, you know, the dehumanizing aspect of violence, the grinding of civilian populations into dust, which we're seeing today, right? I mean, in Ukraine. So it's not departed from us. But it was Paul Fussell was the author of that book. It was probably the most powerful evocation to me of what war was like. So it's more individual books. I love the more recent book by Louis Menon called The Metaphysical Club, which is about the ideas of the late 19th and early 20th centuries. You know that book, yeah.
Oh, that's a wonderful, wonderful book.
Yeah, about Holmes and so many of the great thinkers of the late 19th and early 20th centuries, and gets into, by the way, a lot of the themes that we talk about. There's that whole mood of the early 20th century about progressivism, but progressivism of a certain type that we might now look back and say was still informed by a certain, was informed by eugenics. It was informed by certainly a sort of blatant racism. So progressivism comes in many stripes. I'm a big fan of Fitzgerald. I think he's a graceful, wonderful writer. So there's many who inspire me. Yeah.
Do you, and as someone who thinks deeply about American history, I'm not surprised that historians would be in your mix. The jazz doesn't surprise me because I know you, but I could see how jazz sensibilities play into how you write, the way you craft sentences, the way you mix ideas and metaphors and references. It's very interesting. It's a very jazz-like process for you. Does fiction play a role in your process at all?
No, I'm embarrassed to say that no, I don't really read a lot of fiction, and I think it's in part because I believe that the story that nonfiction has some of the qualities of fiction, some of the elements of look. I mean, we did this in Seen and Unseen, the character building, understanding not just who George Floyd. What happened to George Floyd, but who he was. He becomes a character. I think he becomes real. He becomes flesh and blood in our rendering. Frederick Douglass, you see. I mean, I tried to do this very much in Lincoln's Gamble. Lincoln's Gamble is a book, you know, there's a lot of hagiography about Lincoln. I'm a big fan of Lincoln, but I'm a fan of Lincoln because he was a flawed person, you know, and the 6 months from when he first says he's going to free the slaves to when he actually signs the Emancipation Proclamation is a time of great turmoil for him. We think of him as the great emancipator, and I don't go with I don't think he would have gone with that phrase. I mean,
absolutely would not have.
You think about what we talk about in the last chapter of Seen and Unseen, which is about memorials and monuments and the, you know, sort of glorification of people, which to me is an anti-democratic impulse. I mean, I think Lincoln was great, but I also think he was one of us, you know, and he was flawed, and he was racist. He did not believe in equality. And he hedged about freeing the slaves. He made many steps forward and steps backwards. Frederick Douglass was not convinced on December 31st, the day before Lincoln signs the Emancipation Proclamation, Douglas is saying, I don't think he's going to do it. I don't think he's going to do it. And I think some part of Lincoln's brain, he was thinking, I don't think I maybe am going to do this. I might, I'm not sure, you know? And so you see, I think in nonfiction, some of the elements of fiction, in that we, the characters become, if you do it right, let me put it that way. If you do it right, you portray people in all their complexity and their messiness. This is a favorite word of yours, you know, that I always admire. You say, you know, democracy is messy, right? Race relations are messy. Life is messy. Let's not tidy it up for people, you know, as writers. Let's not tidy it up. Doesn't mean you don't proclaim injustices. It means that you render each person, though, for you give them the dignity of trying to understand their motivations, even some of the worst motivations, right?
Even some of the worst motivations. Speaking of messiness and bad motivations, it is now time for the final part of this interview. It's a thing we do on Coffee and Books. I call it buy it, borrow it, or burn it. Huh. Buy it, borrow it, or burn it. I'm going to give you three books. One you can buy, one you borrow, one you burn.
Wow.
So here's the first book number one. I'll give you all three books and you tell me one you buy, one you borrow, one you burn. You have to do one for each. It brings me great joy. This game tortures my guests.
Right. What if I don't know the book? Well, I may not know these.
I suspect you will.
Okay.
The first book is The Fire Next Time by James Baldwin.
Oh, bye. Absolutely.
No, but I'm
a big Baldwin fan. You know I am a big.
You don't know what's coming next. So one you buy, one you buy. One you buy. Right. I'm giving you all three, then you got to do one for each. The second one is The Game, Harvard, Yale, and America in 1968.
That's written by a friend of mine. You know that, right?
I do. These are not accidental choices. And the third is The Metaphysical Club by Louis Menand.
Yeah.
God, so one you got to, one you can buy, one you can borrow, one you got to burn.
Oh my God. I hope my friend George Howe Colt, who's one of the best writers I know, is not listening to this, because I think I'm gonna go in reverse order here and say that I'll burn The Game. Not because it's not a wonderful book, it is an absolutely wonderful book, but I know I can always go knock on his door and he'll tell me.
you can ask him to tell you about it. Everybody, that book is called The Game, Harvard, Yale, and America in 1968. It's a wonderful book, not just about kind of football and rivalry, but it goes delves much more deeply.
And George is just a fabulous, fabulous writer and godfather to my children. And he's an exquisite human being. So I feel terrible saying that. But as I said, he can tell me, but I can also sort of peek into his bookshelf maybe and see it. Probably The Metaphysical Club, I'm going to say, because I think it's a book you do borrow, and you sort of, the ideas are so rich in it that you're moved by them, and then you want to move on to the next book. But it's an incredibly important book. The Fire Next Time is one of the great pieces of literature of the 20th century, maybe of all American literature. I think Baldwin is Baldwin's messy too, by the way. I'm not sure I would have liked him as a neighbor. I think he's a different kind of he's an acquired taste for some people, but he is an exquisite writer, exquisite thinker. And he's unpredictable. I like writers that are unpredictable. You know, I mean, I don't like didactic writing. Not many people do, but I also don't like people that I feel like I know what they're going to say. I don't know when I pick up a Baldwin book that I'm not familiar with. Like, for instance, I had not read The Evidence of Things Not Seen. That's the book that he wrote about
Child murders. Yeah.
Yeah. And I had not read it, and it had not gotten great reviews. I mean, it was one of those, I think it was his last book, and a lot of reviewers had actually thought of it as an example of a lesser example of his work. Yeah. But I didn't feel so. I read it and I was surprised. I was moved. Baldwin, and if I probably should have chosen Baldwin when you asked me for my favorite books, but Baldwin writes for the eye and the ear, right? I mean, he comes out of the tradition of the church. His father was a preacher. His stepfather was a preacher. He himself considered a career as a preacher. He knows. We talk about this in that chapter about the influencers. He knows how to write for the ear. He knows a pithy phrase, but not just like a facile pithy phrase. He likes to turn words against each other and create opposites and tension between them and all that. So I would, and here's the reason why I want to buy it. I want to read it. And then a couple of years from now, I want to go back and read it again.
Right? I think that makes complete sense. And I will not notify George of your awful choice to burn his book. No, but
yeah, I appreciate that, Mark.
This is a game that no one ever masters, but you've given the best answers of just about anybody. Oh. You're in the upper 5% of people who have answered this book, answered this challenge well. Todd, thank you so much for hanging out with me today on Coffee and Books. I'm glad for the season to be back, and I'm glad to start the season with you. And I can't wait for everybody to go out there and grab our new book. It's called Seen and Unseen: Technology, Social Media, and the Fight for Racial Justice. You can get this book anywhere the books are sold. But of course, we would love for you to get the book at Uncle Bobby's Coffee and Books. You can go to Uncle Bobby's, Uncle BOBBIES.com. You can also grab all the books that we talked about and buy it, borrow it, or burn it. All the books that Todd has previously written, including The Century for Young People, and In Search of America, and of course, Lincoln's Gamble, the tumultuous 6 months that gave America the Emancipation Proclamation and changed the course of the Civil War. Todd, thanks so much.
Well, thank you. It was an honor to be with you, as always. I enjoy our time together, and also to be the first of this new season. I appreciate it. Thank you so much, Mark.
Thank you. Everybody, we'll see you next week. Peace.